Rabbis call him pastor. Pastors call him rabbi. His patients call him doc. And his New York family calls him Meshuggah, crazy, because he believes in Messiah. Welcome to this episode of To Life, where Miles Weiss highlights the hope behind the headlines.
Shalom, all y'all. Good to be with you. This is another edition of To Life. And today my guest is a dear friend and a longtime friend who is a Brooklyn-born Jewish guy who is living in the heartland of Israel, erroneously called the West Bank by news outlets and those that would defame the Promised Land. But he is someone that you would want to hear from. Today is part one of my interview with David Rubin. David Rubin is the former mayor of Shiloh. We say Shiloh here out in Cowboy West, but it is in the heart of Israel. And it is where the Ark of the Covenant lived, rested for 369 years. It is hallowed ground. It is a wonderful place. It's a beautiful community. It looks a lot like Sonoma County, near where I live. And we've been bringing people there for many, many years to hear the story of Hannah, how she prayed for the prophet Samuel from there, and to hear the story of the Ark being there and the way that this is a seminal part of the history of the land itself. Now, he's an unofficial spokesman for Israel. He's written many books, including Trump and the Jews, The Islamic Tsunami, Peace for Peace, and God, Israel, and Shiloh. Often you see him on Fox News, Newsmax TV, One America News. He's written in U.S. News and World Report. He's been a featured speaker all over America. We've hosted him here many times in the Bay Area. And he's thought of as a trusted voice of Israel. You know, it's really important in these days where there's so much noise on the internet and in the media that we hear from people who actually are living the life. They're on the ground and you're hearing a first-person view of what is actually going on there rather than third and fourth hand. I am honored and blessed to have with me today David Rubin. David Rubin, all the way from Jerusalem. It is so good to be with you again, man. We go back so far. And I tempted to call you Mr. Mayor, but as I know you would say, we've been on a first name basis forever, but you've been the mayor of Shiloh. We say in America, Shiloh, but you have been at the center of the recovery kinds of programs for victims of terror there. I first met you at Rosemary Schindler's Judeo-Christian Zionist Congress in the hills of Oakland. And when I heard your story, I was so moved by what happened to you and your son on the road from Jerusalem to Shiloh. I just wanted to get involved, and we've been very blessed to be able to bring hundreds of people up to Shiloh to learn about the heartland of Israel. Give us a little bit of your background and your story of how did you wind up in the mountains of Israel?
Okay, well, we have to go back about 30 years and even a little bit more, but I'm going to give you the very short version. Which is that I was born and raised in a place called Brooklyn that you may have heard of. In fact, I know that you've heard of it.
Yes, the old country.
So that's where I grew up. I moved to Israel after I had a Jewish return to roots. As a teenager, I considered myself to be an atheist. But I moved to the land of Israel. Because of that Jewish return to roots, I realized that I needed to be in God's country, literally. And I moved to Israel. I moved to Shiloh, which I know Americans would know as Shiloh. But what was Shiloh? Shiloh was the first capital of ancient Israel. It was the place where the tabernacle stood for 369 years. It was the place where Hannah came to pray for a son, and the son who was born from her prayers was Samuel the prophet. And so as I said, that's where the tabernacle stood. It was the forerunner of Jerusalem, and eventually the tabernacle left Shiloh, and the temple was built in Jerusalem. But jumping ahead, more to the present, I moved to Shiloh. And I was elected the mayor of Shiloh some years later. And about a year after my term as mayor, I was coming back from Jerusalem along with my three-year-old son. And the car was hit up by terrorists who were on the side of the road with AK-47 assault rifles. They shot at the car. I felt a bullet crash into my leg. And I turned around to my son as the blood was pouring out of my leg. I asked him if he was okay. His eyes were staring straight ahead, wide open. His mouth was wide open. He looked like he was trying to scream or to cry, but no sounds were coming out. I could see that he was breathing. So it was clear to me that he was in shock, or at least that's what I thought. And I tried to start the car. I hit the gas. I turned the ignition. I did everything I could, shifting gears 5-6 times. Finally, the car started. It started as if it had never had a problem starting before. As the terrorists were still shooting, I hit the gas. I drove 110 miles an hour to get up the road to the next community where I hoped I could get an ambulance. Well, I pull up to the front gate. Every community in Samaria, in the so-called West Bank, has metal gate in the front to keep out car bombers. Well, there was a guard at the gate, and I start shouting to him from the car, and I couldn't get out of the car because of my leg. Blood was pouring out of the leg. It was pounding. And I shouted to the guard at the gate. He didn't seem to hear me. There was a young woman on the side of the road. She started jumping up and down, screaming, "Ambulance, ambulance, don't you hear?" At that point, everyone who was within sound's reach came running up to the car. A gas station attendant ran up to the car. He ripped off my shirt. He wrapped on my leg to stop the blood flow. He said, "I'm also a paramedic. Don't worry. I know what I'm doing." And indeed, he did manage to at least ease up the blood flow. And then the ambulance pulled up. Two paramedics came from the ambulance. They run up to the car. One of them pulls my son out of the baby seat. He starts shouting to the ambulance. He's also been shot. He's been shot in the head. A bullet had gone into his head where the skull meets with the neck, causing a skull fracture, internal bleeding in the cerebellum. And we later found out about that. And they quickly wrapped his head with bandages and put an oxygen mask on his face, attached him to an oxygen tank in the ambulance, and put us on stretchers, taking us to the hospital in Jerusalem. We got to the hospital, got to the emergency room, and I was pronounced the 1,000th victim of terrorism to be hospitalized in that hospital just in that past year and a half. And, you know, I'm laying on my back on a stretcher. My son is in the emergency room in the children's ward. And, you know, here I didn't know what was going to happen next, but the head surgeon told me that in another half hour, we're going to have to operate on both of you. But the reason why you were told that you're the 1,000th terror victim is because the media is massed outside this emergency room. They want to interview you and photograph you and your son. And I will keep them away. I will protect your privacy. And so at that moment, I had to think about it. And I, you know, I thought of all the terror victims. I thought of what we had been through in those past few months. And I said, you know what? You bring them in here. I have what to say to them. And I've been telling the story ever since. I tell the story not because of the trauma that we've been through. Lord knows there are many families that have suffered far worse than us. And I tell this story not because of any political message that I have to deliver, even though I do have my opinions and I'm not shy about them. But I tell this story because it's a story of miracles. I was shot in my left leg, even though the terrorists were shooting from the right side, which enabled me to drive my automatic car to get to that ambulance. The bullet that went into my son's head and through his neck missed his brainstem by 1 millimeter. Well, those are the kind of miracles that you can kind of look at, and well, I mean, I look at them, it's clear that they're miracles, but your average atheist will try and rationalize it away. And I wasn't about rationalizing, because it was clear to me that something had happened that was quite extraordinary, extraordinary, supernatural. And finally, 5 days later, I'm laying in my hospital bed, and we had the coup de grace. I'm laying there in my hospital bed. I get a call from the car mechanic. And he says, David, he says, we have the car. I just want to let you know we've started ordering parts. There are 49 bullet holes in the car. It's not going to be easy to fix, but we'll do our best. So don't worry. I said, don't worry? Are you serious? I haven't thought about the car. I don't care about the car. My son was laying in the intensive care unit, sleeping 22 out of 24 hours of the day. He had almost total memory loss. He couldn't lift himself up in his bed. He didn't remember his sisters who came to the hospital to visit him. I said, I don't care about the car right now. I have other worries. He said, I'm just calling you because I have to ask you a question. And then there was silence on the other end of the phone for about 10 seconds. And then he said, why can't we start that car? And a chill went down my neck, down my whole back. And I'll tell you something. I know that the car started. I know I tried to start it over and over and over, and it wasn't starting. But then I know that the car started, and I drove 110 miles an hour to get to that ambulance. The car was shaking the whole time. And I got to the ambulance, and we got to the hospital, and the doctors managed to save our lives. Now, I have to tell you something, and this is a confession. It's a confession, and I'm not even a Catholic. I've been a believer in the God of Israel for over 20 years, over 30 years. And up until that very moment, I still was a skeptic when it came to personal miracle stories. But I'm not a skeptic any longer, Miles, because we were just lifted up on God's wings to get us to that ambulance. And I knew after that happened to us that, yes, a miraculous thing had happened. And, you know, we have an expression in Hebrew, Hakol Tova, which means everything is for good. And it doesn't mean that everything that happens is good. We know that bad things happen to good people, but we also know that everything happens for a good reason. And at that point, I started to look for the good reason, to start to understand what it was all about. And I was so upset about the terrorism that we had experienced in the previous year, and I was so upset about the terrorism that we experienced. But I knew that something good had to come out of it, and I had a vision of a therapeutic educational campus where we could somehow combine therapy with education and do it for the children. And I have to tell you now, jumping ahead 15 years, 16 years, in fact, we now have that therapeutic educational campus, which is growing and expanding all the time and improving itself. And we have over 2,000 children who have been affected by terrorism and many of them deeply traumatized by terrorism. And we are healing the trauma of the terror victim children and restoring a lot of the lost innocence of childhood to these children.
Wow. I hope you are as blessed by that story as I am. I've heard it many, many times, and it never gets old. You know, David made a choice. He vowed to retaliate against terror, but not with hatred, not with anger, but with compassion to create positive change for the children of Israel. It is profoundly touching. It's daunting to realize that that is what we've been called to do. And you can hear in every line of his testimony in this part one, you can hear the hope behind the headlines, that he is looking to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's believing God for peace, soul to soul, person to person, and he is put that into action in a way to recover those who have been damaged by terrorism. I'm moved and I'm touched and I'm glad that you're part of this. If you like this, if you hear it, if it means something to you, then please share it with others. Feel free to give us a thumbs up on your media outlets and just really promote these podcasts. We believe that God is going to use them to touch hearts and to change lives. So until next time, look for the hope behind the headlines.